Welcome to Appointed.
Well, it's so fantastic to be here with you. We're joined by Josephine Gray to talk about food insecurity in Canada. I've known you, Joe, since, I don't know, well, let's not talk about how long we've known each other, but a long, long time since pre and post children, and now you're a grandmother, so it's amazing. So you're a community and human rights advocate. You're the co-founder of FoodShare, low-income families of Toronto, and low-income families together, as I used to know it, and St. James Town Community Cooperative. You're also the co-founder and co-organizer of the Oasis Food Hub and of the EcoJust Food Network. I know that you've done like a million times more things than that, and you have been in one of the most amazing, inspirational advocates with and on behalf of so many folks. So thank you so much for joining us on Appointed.
Thank you.
So, Joe, I don't want to speak for you, but you have an incredible amount of lived experience in this area, and that has informed your work, particularly your unwaged work. Could you share whatever of that experience you're comfortable letting our audience know about?
Thank you. So I'm a person of mixed race descent, so I come from African and Celtic roots, and my children are additionally African and Indigenous. So I have a unusual perspective on systemic racism and history and the like, and live in a very, very diverse community. So this has led me to be really passionate about making sure that we work together on human rights across all these differences and across all these different forms of heritage. It's also shown me how systemic racism and poverty and inequity play out right here in the heart of Toronto, where we have so many people crammed into this concrete jungle. And from that, I recognize that human rights for everyone and all human rights are interdependent and indivisible and very important. So that's why I'm a human rights educator and defender. But also in raising my children and struggling to feed them, so I found the experience of going to food banks very humiliating, very difficult, and realized that the food wasn't very healthy. I became very involved in international politics during the 90s as the trade agreements were coming in, and I was sent to Copenhagen by the government along with a large delegation of people to work on the World Summit of Social Development, and I was appointed as domestic observer. I believe I'm one of the only United Nations observers who has the mandate to focus on domestic issues, and that's been part of what's been driving my work ever since, is my commitment to look out for human rights, social development for all people in Canada.
And you've done a phenomenal job of it. You have done so many things, waged, mostly unwaged, and have had an incredible career. And you're currently organizing EcoJust Food Network. And I'm curious as to what it was that brought you to this. I mean, I have some idea, but I think for those who are listening who may not know, what is it that caused you to first work in these areas and now have you working on such an important issue as food security?
Oh, thanks for asking. My mother was very aware of environmental issues and very concerned about land use and farmland and things. And we used to watch as development was encroaching on farmland around the Toronto area. And then when I became a single parent, which wasn't my plan, I found the struggles of trying to feed my children healthy food really difficult. It was the 80s, and it was just as food banks were becoming a thing. And the first time I went to a food bank and first of all endured the humiliating process of qualifying for help, And then got the food home and realized I couldn't eat most of it. It was clear to me that something had to be done around making it possible for low-income people to access healthy food. I also happen to have chemical sensitivities, which I'm very lucky my mother identified early on in my life. So I was very aware of what's in our food from an early age because I had to avoid a number of different chemical additives. So all of those things led me to feel that work needed to be done at the very roots of the food system. And I got very involved in trying to protect farmland and then became a co-founder of FoodShare Toronto.
That's amazing. And I mean, thank goodness for the work you're doing. And you know, one of the things that's still shocking to me some days is how many people don't remember a time when we didn't have food banks, when we didn't have people begging in the streets in this country. And, you know, my personal opinion is we need to get back to that, obviously. But you already have touched upon the issue of the encroachment on farmland in terms of urbanization and the focus on more capitalist ventures. I'm wondering if you're comfortable talking a bit about how climate change is impacting the food system, as well as how here in Canada that is particularly problematic and impacting communities that are marginalized.
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, we're already in a situation over the last couple of decades where more and more factory-type farming has been taking over farmland as well. So as large corporate-backed farms have been utilizing more machinery and more chemical inputs, usually petroleum-based, you know, it's been forcing crops to grow into harvest, but a lot of those crops aren't very safe in the first place. But there are also large fields that require big machines. And when there's a shift in the season, when there's a, you know, an early rain or an early freeze or things like that, we've seen already many times when crops have been damaged or have died in the field as a result of unexpected weather or weather events. So that's part of the problem. Then, of course, you know, many of the places where we import our food, we have way too many very long distance supply lines. And many of the places from where we import our food are being badly impacted by climate change, even more so than we are. And that's, for example, California, where, you know, the state has been consumed by wildfires. And that's where a lot of our winter food has been coming from. So that's just one example of many different ways in which climate change is impacting our food system far and wide, as well as here at home.
Mm-hmm. And I know you've been really, really busy during this time. And, you know, the pandemic has revealed in so many ways the precarity of our delivery systems, particularly for food. And I'm curious as to, you know, what your observations are with respect to this, as also what you think about what our governments have chosen to do around food insecurity during the pandemic.
Well, to back up a little, I think in St. Jamestown, where I live, which is a very densely populated high-rise community of over 20,000 people and is the most diverse community in the world, some 160 languages are spoken here. For the last 8 years or so, we've been focusing on what would a solution be for a community like ours in downtown Toronto, which is essentially a concrete jungle. And many great minds from around the world came up with the Oasis Food Hub model. And we decided that in addition to making stronger connections with our local farmers and figuring out better ways to engage with farmers so that they can make a decent livelihood and we can eat healthy food, we also realized that farmers themselves also need healthy food during the winter and can't provide for themselves everything, of course. So we realized that growing food in the city in climate-controlled spaces is a very, very important strategy for us to try to achieve food security. So we've been trying to get this model going, and it involves things like setting up aquaponics facilities and underground swimming pools and mushroom growing and underground spaces. We have a lot of unused underground parking. We looked at a range of life-affirming technologies that would help us to achieve the goal of growing food during the winter in the community. We also, you know, have done a lot of interaction with local farmers, and we partnered with the National Farmers Union to have a food forum in 2018 where we discussed a number of issues of concern around climate change and the like. And then as the pandemic came along, we switched our next emergency food forum to an online, or our next forum to an online emergency food forum. And we involved a wide range of people in the food system, from, you know, food NGOs to food co-ops, farmers, people working in food banks, people working on the front lines in communities. And between us, we came up with, first of all, a lot of concerns around the risks that we were facing with this pandemic and how it was impacting the most vulnerable communities, particularly where a lot of essential workers live in these very vulnerable communities. And we did a lot of brainstorming around the kinds of solutions that would need to be introduced in order to start shifting our food system to become more climate resilient, but also able to function in emergencies like this pandemic.
It's amazing. And it's always amazing to me, the creativity that too often we don't know about. I didn't know that's some of what you were working on, although here in Ottawa, my sister who lives in public housing has been part of a cooperative approach that she does with her neighbors. And it strikes me that the ability to move beyond the processes that have been put in place is vitally important. And I know you sent an open letter to the government about this. Have you received support from outside of your community for the just, sustainable, pandemic, climate-resistant, healthy food systems that you're promoting?
Well, quite a lot of organizations and academics and people who are concerned about these issues have signed on to it. We haven't gotten any response yet from government, but we also haven't pushed it that hard. I'm basically trying to build up some more momentum and get more folks to be able to agree on the key points so that we have a unified voice when we approach the federal government. We are hoping that the city government will join in, because the city itself is struggling very hard to keep up with all the needs in our area. We have, you know, we've had tens of thousands of people camping outside, homeless people, very long food bank lineups, lots of people left with empty bags when the food runs out. There's an awful lot of problems that Toronto is struggling to deal with. And people are in a bit of a state of chaos. And I think there's a very heavy reliance on the status quo, the food bank system. There's some emerging awareness around the need to tackle food waste and to divert food that's being wasted for the sake of supply and demand and not because there's anything wrong with it. So those things are good. However, in a pandemic, when our food supply is becoming insecure, I think it's very unsafe to expect that food banks will be able to rally and gather both surplus food and surplus labor. I mean, how do you get enough volunteers in a pandemic when we are under lockdown? And where is all this extra surplus food going to come from? You know, there are those on the producer end, particularly farmers, who are very anxious and very worried about their ability to continue farming in a good way. Like, we're talking mostly sustainable farmers who are paying attention to the health of the soil, who are paying attention to the amount of nutrients in the food. They've had a terrible struggle during this pandemic, partly because of the lack of migrant labor and even local labor. There have been many crops plowed under because they couldn't get them off the field. So while people are standing in food bank lines, there are crops being plowed under, which is a really tragic situation. And I feel that so far, government has been unsurprisingly somewhat short-sighted. And part of that is because we don't have a Ministry of Food. We don't have a sort of body that oversees the food system. We have, you know, Ministry of Agriculture that works with the farm sector. We have, you know, public health and other bodies that work with various aspects of the food system, but there doesn't seem to be any particular oversight other than perhaps the Food Policy Council in Toronto. That's a body of volunteers that currently doesn't have any staff, has very little influence, especially at a time like this. So we felt that pulling together a wide range of people engaged in whether needing the food or producing the food was a really important step to take to make an urban-rural relationship and build up an urban-rural relationship so that we could have direct communication and direct exchange of food and labor would be really critically key. So in addition to coming up with some very specific demands around how, or recommendations around how to reallocate investment in food infrastructure to make it more sustainable, to make the livelihoods of people working in the food system more adequate and appropriate, to make sure the food itself is actually healthy and safe to consume. In addition to that, we decided that we needed to be developing ways in which we can organize with each other to actually get the food going. So we've sent, for instance, young people out to farms to help farmers harvest, brought the harvest back to vulnerable communities. And, you know, it's a labor of love. It's been very challenging. We've had to do it with no funding. But people are doing what they can, and we really feel that, you know, this kind of effort towards a more sustainable and just food system is critical to our survival. So we're hoping that people will begin to understand that the illusion of food security in this country is just that. It's an illusion, and we are actually very, very at risk. And perhaps if we start, you know, modeling and giving examples of how we can have that urban-rural relationship to increase our food supply and to help farmers make a living producing healthy food, even though it takes more time and more labor and more hands on the land, that the government and the public will begin to understand how important this is for everybody's well-being.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly as we're hearing talk about, you know, one of the areas I'm working on a lot is the whole area of guaranteed livable income and the impact of mechanization and some of the issues you're talking about will have on future work. But you're talking about ways for people to actually be investing in their own and their, not just individually, but collectively in their own, their interests. And so we will attach to this podcast, so if people are looking at the notes to this, they'll be able to see your letter. Can you lay out for us what the key recommendations are? You've done amazing amounts of work and are modeling how food security and health for particularly Black, Indigenous, and other racialized people could be and should be front of mind and should be one of the focal points. You've also made some recommendations about what we should be prioritizing in terms of our food systems. And I suspect you could speculate if we did this, what our food system would look like 50 years from now. So maybe lay that out a bit more, not just for our listeners, but quite frankly, for me too. So, and then I'd, you know, like to hear what you think people like me should be doing, what those listening who may not have thought of this before could be doing, but as well, what we as legislators, as people have a responsibility to be looking at the issues and concerns of those who aren't often represented by the electorate, as well as those who are elected officials should be doing. So a whole lot of questions, but if I know, knowing you, I know how capable you are of telling us exactly what we need to do and how, where we need to go.
Well, to begin with, I think it's important for folks to understand that if we want to see a healthy, stable, sustainable society, we have to take all human rights into account. And many people are not aware of the human rights treaties Canada has signed. The International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights has a range of articles that Canada is legally committed to uphold and protect, although many people aren't really aware of them. And that includes the right to food. The right to food covers not just that people get to eat, but it covers the fact that the food should be healthy, it should be affordable, it should be culturally appropriate. Let us, for example, point out that people from the global south need a different kind of diet than people from the global north. We need to be able to feed people what actually makes them healthy. So we need to look at the various rights that we have agreed to as a nation and figure out how to adjust our government systems and our public investments to reflect and respect those human rights. I'm a human rights organizer for the very reason that I know that you can't solve these issues of inequity and hunger and all these other things by simply focusing on one thing at a time. So as you raise, for example, the issue of basic income, that's incredibly important to us because we believe that if we're going to be able to shift our systems, to shift our livelihoods, to become more sustainable, to mitigate climate change, to adapt to the effects of climate change, people need the ability, the control of their time to be able to change their behaviors and do things differently, change their careers and things like that. So basic income is an incredibly important strategy for giving communities, farmers, food producers, the freedom to adapt and change what we do. We are in the open letter, we have raised the fact that the government has agreed to the Milan Food Agreement, for example, at least Toronto has. The Milan Food Agreement is a very comprehensive agreement that discusses the importance of changing our farming systems, of changing the kinds of food that we make available in our systems, of changing how food is accessed. It can't just be controlled by a corporate-controlled market that's always seeking profit. This is leading to swiftly rising food prices. Farmers are all in debt. People can't afford to eat. This is not a good equation. So we're in the letter, we're raising the point and making links to the National Food Policy, the Milan Food Agreement, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, as frameworks that we already have and policy commitments we've already made that can shape how government begins to respond to this. We're also raising the fact that there are unsafe and unjust working conditions throughout the food system, in meat processing plants, in food processing plants, in a whole range of areas of our food and health systems. There are bad working conditions and people aren't being paid enough to even afford healthy food. It's very frustrating, for example, to live in a community where you can see healthy organic food, but you can't afford it. It's only available to the very wealthy. But even the very wealthy are going to find themselves struggling when there isn't enough food in the supply chain. So we have put those major agreements on the table as a starting point, and then we have emphasized that the communities most at need are also communities who have suffered the most from a history of exploitation, of colonization, of cultural genocide, of taking over land. And we are emphasizing that the people who do a lot of the work in our food system, of growing it, harvesting it, are often Black or Indigenous or from the global south. We're also showing how, explaining, hopefully people will understand that we need the knowledge of our Indigenous people here, of the First Nations, to help us figure out how to get through a lot of these emergencies, weather chaos, things like that, because the First Nations of this land had a very, very sustainable food system. And I've learned a lot about the various methods that they used to ensure that nobody went hungry, including always having stores of food in case of bad seasons, in case of, you know, hurricanes or whatever. We also need to be making sure that we are building up food reserves for every community. And if we want essential workers and the people of color who are on the front lines of the grocery stores and in the food factories and working on the farms to be able to continue to do that work, we have to make sure they have decent accommodations, decent livelihoods, decent incomes. At the same time, you know, people of African descent have often land in the near south, like in the Caribbean, where we could be growing sustainable, in a sustainable way, we could be growing tropical produce to help feed people in the city when we are in our winter and spring season, when we don't have any food growing here. And like, people aren't thinking about that very much. You know, how do we sustainably source healthy food when we're unable to provide it because we're a country with a long winter season? So we're trying to bring these threads all together based on those international agreements and on the policies that have been devised by various levels of government. And we're asking that they actually take the steps to animate and activate these policies and these agreements and work with the communities who are on the front lines, who are growing the food, who are processing food, to change our food system so that everyone is able to participate in it in a meaningful way and not be exploited in the process, because that's just not safe or sustainable either. When, there's a disproportionate number of folks of color who've been affected by COVID because they live in crowded, dense conditions because they don't have healthy diets. So as we are making urgent recommendations to invest in those communities, to invest in making sure that people working in those areas are properly paid and well cared for, it's also for everybody's sake. So we're asking that the government, the civil society, and civil service work closely together to figure out local solutions, because every place is a little different, right? Some places, indigenous reserves have a lot of farmland, some places they don't. We could be growing a lot of food at Six Nations. We could be growing a lot of food in various parts of the GTA where there's no food being grown now, and many people could be contributing to that. So how can we shift our food system to become more just and more sustainable? Doing that with knowledge that's already present, whether it's with First Nations people, whether it's with migrant farm laborers, or whether it's folks who've been doing a lot of academic research, and particularly agroecological farmers who have done enormous amounts of work on how our agriculture system can both mitigate climate change, but also begin to reverse it by, you know, making our soils healthier, by sequestering more carbon. If we pay attention to what people who are actually growing our food are saying about how to change our system, and if we pay attention to all the steps along the way from field to table, we have the resources, we have the knowledge, we know what we need to do. It's just, we all need to be able to change our focus and work together to make it happen. So I think a really important thing for us to pay attention to is that, you know, when people first came to settle here with the First Nations, they agreed to the Dish With One Spoon Treaty, and that's a treaty to protect and preserve the natural resources and food supply of the Great Lakes region. So we're asking that people respect and honor that treaty, particularly in light of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. So the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is a very, very important covenant that we really want everyone to understand and to honor, because the United Nations itself has said that humanity's future survival will depend on learning from and respecting indigenous stewardship of the land. And it is absolutely vital that we understand that if we don't take care of our ecological resources, our forests, our fields, our soil, we're not going to survive as a species. In addition to that, this country has also, a little late in the day, but agreed to the UN Decade for Peoples of African Descent. And there are many folks who are both African and Indigenous who have an awful lot to offer in how we move forward with a healthier, more sustainable society. And it's well long past due for peoples of African descent to have the restitution that they deserve and be a part of creating a better and healthier future for all of us, particularly because they are negatively impacted on a disproportionate level, and we are seeing an awful lot of suffering which is based on systemic racism. So this is one of the reasons why we focused on that in our open letter and in our strategy, but I want to really emphasize that we are not proposing to segregate people and have different food systems. We are trying to bring everyone together to have one good, strong, secure, healthy food system, knowing that Indigenous people and peoples of African descent need to be at the root of that system.
Absolutely. And thank you for reminding us of that, because that is really, as you've underscored, the underlying and underpinning values and principles of the Dish with One Spoon Treaty, as well as the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and many of the other not just declarations, but commitments and covenants that Canada has signed on to. So thank you for reminding of us of that. And thank you especially for reminding us of the importance of working together collectively and redistributing the resources that we have. I mean, we're being reminded of this right now as we deal with the situation of First Nations fishers on the East Coast being their livelihood being interrupted, instead of people looking at the collective ways in which the fisheries, the farming, the hunting, the resource, the use of resources, and the collective impact of how we use resources occurs in this country. And I can't think of a better way to end than thanking you for the incredible commitment you've had, the energy you've put into this, the way you inspire so many others to continue to do this work in an intersectional way, in a way that recognizes Canada is a very rich country in terms of resources, human resources, natural resources, and fiscal resources. And there's no reason that anybody should be left behind in this country. And so thank you for the work you do and for inspiring all of us to do better and to ensure that nobody is left behind.
Thank you, Kim.
No, thank you.